Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And today it's Kathleen's birthday. So first of all, happy birthday, darling.
Thank you very much.
And for people who know anything about Kathleen, they will know that she has made one of the pillars of her work, the importance of the vernal equinox. And so we are indeed on the vernal equinox, and it's a time of tremendous change. That is definitely the case. It's the beginning of the astrological year, and for people who thought that 2011 was going to be a quieter time than 2010, well, clearly that is not the case.
Well, it has certainly come in like a lion, as they say. The vernal equinox represents the beginning of the natural year, the beginning of the astrological year, as well, as you say. So it is a time of new beginnings. But the word equinox means equal night. It's the day, or actually it's a series of days, because it actually works over about three of them total, in which day and night are of perfect length. And as a result, we think energetically that it will be a time of balance. But it has certainly not been the case of late. This has been a very tumultuous equinox for a lot of people. We had this phenomenal full moon going on, this incredible super moon the day before. And it's just been a really powerful energetic time. There's so much going on in the world that we decided that today, rather than having an interview or taking on a specific subject, we would talk about a number of things. We do kind of an equinox wrap-up show where we handle a couple of subjects and just kind of update you on where we've been in our work and in our research and the things that we've observed, because it's been a very, very active time for us as well. So that's what's going to happen today. It's our equinox show, and we're going to talk about new beginnings, and we're also going to talk about all the changes that are going on in the world. But we're going to hit on some really, really interesting subjects, everything from Japan to God's wife. So hang in there with us, and I think you might have some fun.
Absolutely. And one of the things which is happening, obviously, is the massive celebrations. We're going to talk about Egypt, and on the 21st of March, the vernal equinox is when the Sphinx gazes to the rising sun, just like it does on the fall equinox. But it's one of these things that the equinox was also said to be the time of the angels, the time of perfection. And we've done some shows on kind of like angels and stuff. But here is one of the beautiful legends, which I always think involves a time, this everlasting spring, this idea of a time to come. And in the 16th and 17th century, there was a belief that at the equinox, the time returned to the time when it was in the first time, when the earth was beautiful, when there was no strife, when there was no chaos in this world. And it had to do with the way of the fact that the axis of the earth is aligned straight, and which is always only happening at the equinoxes. So this moment of perfection was identified by the vernal and the fall equinox, but it was specifically the vernal equinox because of its spring, because of its vibrance, because of its green connotations that stood out more so than the vernal moment in time and an echo of eternity. People all around the world are beginning to celebrate it. We know about the gatherings which exist in Stonehenge on the June 21st, but in Mexico, I was extremely happy to see how thousands of Mexicans gathered in places such as Chichen Itza and Teotihuacan, because there people have identified through archaeology, but also through a living tradition, that these places have a very important link to the vernal equinox. And so I was reading newspaper articles about how, again, thousands of people were gathering there, but also how all of a sudden the tourist board in Mexico is unhappy, because somehow they have singled out these two moments in time of the equinox as a bad place. Because they are saying that tourists are more than welcome to come to these places, but you're not welcome on the vernal equinox because there are too many people there. And obviously what you're trying to say is this, this is an archaeological site, this is dead, this shouldn't be celebrated. This is a thing of the past, and now it's just for tourism. So all of you people who want to actually make this part of a living tradition, go away. We don't want you. This is what the Mexican Tourist Board is saying quite clearly. So I was a bit disappointed with that. And it also kind of shows how, you know, every country needs to get out of the old ways and move into the new ones. And I would say Mexico has a bit to go.
Well, I think it's extremely disappointing for a lot of reasons. The first is their reluctance to celebrate their past and to look at the beauty and the richness of the history of the people and the beliefs that actually were the inspiration for these extraordinary monuments that exist in Mexico. I smell the Catholic Church in this particular decision. This feels very, very much like a religious decision. We don't want pagan celebrations in our land at this time. We've certainly seen this before. But I think it is extremely disappointing. But I also think it's a foolish decision for Mexico and for the Mexican government and for the Mexican Tourist Authority to do anything at this time to discourage tourism. Given what's been happening in Mexico for the last year, I think that they should welcome, encourage, and protect anything that is inviting international tourism. That country needs it. Its economy needs it. I'm a Southern Californian third generation. We have a very, very close connection to Mexico. We can drive across the Mexican border in less than 2 hours from where we live. I come from a culture where everyone goes to Mexico on vacation all the time on a regular basis. You can go to Mexico for the weekend, and nobody is doing that anymore. It's not safe to travel in Mexico. What's been happening in Mexico over the last 2 years has really, really deterred people who would normally just hop down to Mexico from going at all. There is no way I would go to Mexico right now. I certainly wouldn't take my family or do, you know, anything that I think could endanger them. And so I wouldn't go to Mexico. And I think a lot of people feel that way. So what I think the Mexican Tourism Board and the Mexican government should be focusing on is reassuring tourists that they will be safe and protected in their very beautiful country, as opposed to worrying about whether or not a pagan tradition is something that they don't want celebrated in their country. Get your priorities straight, Mexico.
And speaking of pagan traditions and origins and where we have come from, this week also saw a discovery, which really is only a rediscovery, about the fact, or as the newspapers reported, the possibility that God might have a wife.
Well, you know, first of all, it's not a possibility. It is a fact. It's just that it's now becoming more and more accepted that it is a fact. You know, none of this is new, and this is one of the things that I want to say. There is some fantastic new information coming out that isn't really new information. It's just that a very gifted scholar in the UK has put it all together in a new and fresh way that's getting a lot of attention. And for that, I celebrate her. So I don't mean to downplay her extraordinary work. Her name is now I'm going to try very hard not to butcher her beautiful Greek name, but it's a little bit tricky. Her name is Francesca Stavrakopoulou. It's easier to say than it is to read. It's quite a long name. Professor Stavrakopoulou is at the University of Exeter. I think she did her original studies in Oxford. Has done phenomenal work on this idea of the cult of Asherah, of the fact that God had a wife and that wife's name was Asherah, and that there are many, many references to her in ancient texts, in the Old Testament. And certainly some of the most important have been on inscriptions that have been found on artifacts and pottery. It's getting a lot of attention right now because her work has been turned into a series of documentaries that are airing in the UK at this moment. I am trying to get more information on that because I'd love to see these documentaries and I'd love to get access to them and certainly give information to you all about how to see them. I don't have that yet, but I am working on it. But bravo to her for bringing this back to the forefront, this idea that God had a wife. Certainly, if you've read my novel, The Book of Love, it's about this idea that God had a wife and that her name is Asherah. And again, this is not a new concept. For me, one of my primary sources on this subject, which is a book that I absolutely love with all my heart, and I think that everyone who cares about this subject should have this book in their library, and it is a book called Did God Have a Wife? The Archaeology and Folk Religion in Ancient Israel by William G. Deaver, D-E-V-E-R. And there's a tremendous amount of information in Mr. Deaver's book, and I recommend it wholeheartedly. But, you know, this idea of God having a wife, as I said, is not a new one, but it is very exciting that more and more proof and evidence is coming out. And that's what I love about this time in history where we are right now. You know, my vernal equinox celebration and prayer is may more and more of these things continue to come to the surface. One of the things, one of the primary pieces of evidence that's used in this proof about not just there being an Asherah and there having been a cult of Asherah, we know this from the Old Testament. It's in the Book of Kings. But this idea that definitively she was the partner of Jehovah, she was the partner of God, this is the piece that is really exciting. The primary piece of evidence for this comes from a piece of pottery that was discovered in the Sinai Desert. The pottery was dated back to the 8th century BC, and it contains an inscription. And the inscription is a petition. It is something asking for a blessing. And it is asking for a blessing from, quote, Yahuwah and his Asherah. And that inscription is the one that really grabs me more than any other. Yahuwah and his Asherah. It's not Yahuwah and Asherah, which could be potentially interpreted differently. But this idea of it being a possessive form, to me, says very specifically these people are petitioning a divine couple, a divine pair. And I think that's very exciting. And apparently in Professor Stavrakopoulou's work, she has actually uncovered a number of other artifacts that have been discovered since that back up this this particular inscription. Again, I'm trying to get more information on her work. I'm trying to dig deeper into it and see more of her research because I think what she's doing is fantastic. And we will keep you posted on all of this. The final thing I want to say on this subject is, you know, it's always so sad and disappointing to me when I go online and I see articles about this. And then the mistake that I make is that I scroll down and I read the comments. And, you know, I really should learn by now that when I find a beautiful article that celebrates somebody's brilliance and some extraordinary discovery that really is important to the world, I should stop at the end of the article and not read the comments, because I get to these people, these Bible thumpers who are posting all over this article that we're all going to hell because of this horrific pagan idea. And it's just, it's so sad to me that there are still so many people out there that are resistant to something so beautiful as this idea that God has a divine partner who is a woman. And I will never, never for the life of me understand why that is a threatening concept, why that is so scary to so many traditional Christians. But apparently it is. And so for me, that's the heartbreak in this. But I'm not going to focus on the heartbreak. I'm going to focus on the excitement of it and continue to be excited about these scholars who are really putting all this information together, who are really pushing it out to the forefront, and who continue to discover these incredible pieces of evidence that prove to us what we absolutely definitively know, which is that God has a divine partner, and that is his wife, Asherah.
Absolutely. And that brings us in the region where we had one of our last shows, which wasn't an interview, where we're tackling the Egyptian Revolution, which was at that moment in time happening. Right now, Egypt has had national elections, first of probably many. They are constitutional reforms which are going to allow for normal elections to occur with a date tentatively set for September, I believe. It's been a time of great change. The last time we left you, the great Zahi Hawass was still in power as Minister of Antiquities. And since then, he has gone. In fact, it was, for me personally, a very troublesome time because I was finishing an article. And whenever you're reporting on actual events and you know your article is going to be published a month from closing your article and submitting it, it's sometimes difficult. And I had submitted the article in which Zahi Hawass was still in power as Minister of Antiquities, and then he resigned 3 hours before the article went to print. So thank you, Doc Kenyon, editor and owner of Atlantis Rising, for an extremely late rewrite of that article in a number of places, which brought it up to date. But it just shows you, I think, that you know, when Zahi Hawass falls, and we'll go into a bit more detail as to how precisely he fell, what times are changing. Because if I were to do a poll, and I would say, give me a bully, give me a guy who is derogatory about just about anybody, but specifically about women, give me a name of any of a person who represents old authority, the old ways of the past, then apart from Dick Cheney, probably Zahi Hawass comes to mind, because he does represent that. And, well, he's gone. He is arrivederci and nowhere to be seen, except on his own webpage. He, you know, he has gone. And when I announced the news of his resignation on my Facebook page, my public Facebook page, I could see the reticence of people who were so kind of going, are you sure? Has this happened? No, he'll come back.
Absolutely.
He, and you kind of go, no, he has gone. This is, you know, he has gone, he has resigned. And people just couldn't accept the fact that he really was gone.
No, we saw that over and over again on, you know, on our Facebook, on our public pages, that when we were celebrating the overthrow of this dictator of antiquities, so many people came onto our pages and said, no, he'll be back. He'll be back. Of course he'll be back. You can't, there's no way. There's no way. People had gotten so entrenched in this idea that Zahi Hawass was never going to leave, and that he was somehow invincible. And so we kept saying over and over again, no, this is real. He's really, really gone. Why do you think that is? Why, is it just because he, I didn't feel that the people who were saying this were saying it because they loved him and they didn't want him to go. Do you think it is sort of a tribute to how he was able to make us all believe that we could not live without him?
Well, I mean, yes and no. The biggest issue is with people who do know him and who've read some of my articles. Under the Mubarak regime, Hawass on two occasions was or should have been fired from his position, one as Egyptian director of the Giza Plateau and one in his position of SEA. On the first issue, it had to do with theft of statues from the Giza Plateau, and he was suspended and then he came back. The second instance with the SEA was when his right-hand man was thrown in jail for massive corruption, and he basically said and got away with the fact by saying that he did not know that this was happening under his very nose. So what was happening was always that whatever you threw at Hawass, including chasing mummies, the guy would not go. He was there and he would always be there. No matter what happened, he would survive this. But what people didn't realize, I think, is that the people who held his hand had gone. Mubarak had gone. Hosni had gone. Hosni was the Minister of Culture in which he reported into for most of his life. Hosni, who was a hated culture minister, he could not leave or he could not go anywhere in a public place without at least 6 Secret Service people around him, because people wanted to attack him. This is how much this man was hated. So he always had the protection of these people. And then the third protecting party was what I will call the Americans, specifically American universities and American TV stations, specifically Discovery and specifically National Geographic, who poured an enormous amount of money into Egyptian coffers and sometimes, you know, in other places as well. And what happened was that people said, well, okay, Mubarak has gone, Hosni has gone, but the Americans will keep him into place because this is their preferred method of channeling money into Egypt for the best archaeological sites, always going to Americans. The documentaries, which get so much money, and which sometimes gives $5 million in equipment for this to be enabled. But really, the Egyptians right now do not give a damn about America. They only care about getting their country back up the road as a proper working and functioning country. And that is what they care about, because looking to what America will do next hasn't helped them. It only helped Mubarak. So, going into some of the detail as to what actually has been happening and what has been uncovered is something which makes me want to cry, because there is a very detailed article on a website which goes about how Hawass was handling the new Egyptian museum. The Egyptian museum, the old entry was entrance wasn't really up to date and was going to be redone. And he felt that the bookshop, which was in the museum, was below par. And so he said, okay, new entrance, new bookshop. And what's going to happen next is typical. He was going to give the new bookshop operating to a company in which he was a shareholder, and also the American University was a partner. The people who had been running, the family who had been running the old bookshop, however, put in a bid to run the new bookshop. And Hawass went out of his way to make sure that these people did not get it, including, details which are so horrific. In short, those people have now filed a lawsuit against Hawass, and if Hawass is convicted, he will go to jail for 1 year for basically doing stuff without, it's the competition law whereby he basically went out of his way to make sure that there was no competition. He did the most atrocious things. But then, something which beggars belief. If it hadn't been supported by 1,600 pages of documentation. And this is the allegation that he, together with Farouk Hosni and Suzanne Mubarak, the wife of Hosni Mubarak, stole and sold Egyptian antiquities up to a value of 1.6 billion, and I repeat, billion dollars. That is a phenomenal amount of corruption. And the police are saying that they are looking into it. Unfortunately, there has been so much corruption in Egypt, including people higher up the food chain of politics, that at this moment in time, they are still concentrating on the likes of Mubarak, Hosni, and various other people, including the Minister of the Interior, before they will be able to get to Hawass. But basically, what happened is this, and this is, I think, a very interesting sign. When the new Prime Minister of Egypt was appointed, Hawass was still a Minister of Antiquities, because it was up to the new minister to identify who would become and how he would organize the various posts. And it wasn't all too clear what was going to happen with the Ministry of Antiquities, because what had happened was that Mubarak had taken Hawass's reporting role into the Ministry of Culture out of that line of reporting and make Hawass a proper minister, a proper politician. By making him a politician rather than a scientist, it also meant that Hawass all of a sudden wasn't really required to resign as everybody else. It was a political role, and there is no mandate to retire as a politician at a certain age. So it was going to be interesting to see. Now, as soon as the new prime minister was identified, journalists like Antoine Gigal immediately said, "This is the end of Hawass. This prime minister is not going to allow Hawass to remain in his function." And 5 minutes later, Hawass said, "Oh, I cannot live with this prime minister. This prime minister is not good for Egypt. If he invites me to become Minister of Antiquities, I will have to decline." So once again, he was basically trying to say that he was still in charge, but he no longer was, because the choice of prime minister, this guy was not going to allow Hawass to become Minister of Antiquities. And guess what? He didn't even go through the motions of asking Hawass. He appointed somebody else, And then there was some debate, and this debate is actually still ongoing as of today, because what the Prime Minister had done was he once again made a Minister of Culture in which antiquities would report into. And he is now reconsidering that idea, and he's thinking of actually making a Minister of Antiquities position, and he's going around these circles. One person who was almost going to have it up until a few days ago was the former professor Ala Shaheen, a man who I actually personally know. He was the head of Cairo University. He is the person who became embroiled in an internet controversy, as allegedly at a conference he said that there was UFO technology hidden underneath the Giza Plateau. Now, I know Ala Shaheen, he would never say anything or come close to that, and he has since denied ever having said that, and has challenged the person in Australia who claims that he said this at a conference. It's a very weird saying that if there are hundreds of people at a conference and none of them report Ala Shaheen saying this, yet somebody in Australia who wasn't there is claiming this. It's a very bizarre story. But anyway, Ala Shaheen is definitely a man who is very is younger. He's of a more open generation. He's still a man, and he's still an Egyptian man, so he comes with all of those attributes, which Zahir had as well. But it now appears that for reasons which aren't totally clear, he might not get the post. I'm personally thinking that Ibrahim Ali, who's another person I know, and who is the Dean of Archaeology for Ain Shams University, which is the other big Cairo university, might be a forerunner now as well. Of the two, Ibrahim Ali was always considered to be the more political rather than archaeological strong person. Shaheen was more of a scientist than a politician, but also Ibrahim Ali was also a person who actually stood up more to Zahi Hawass. I remember Ibrahim Ali saying at one point that just before I met him, he had been in a meeting, and Zahi Hawass had been one of those people. And I said, "How did it go?" And Ibrahim Ali said, "He shouted at me, I shouted at him." And that is kind of like, the outspokenness which you get with an Ibrahim Ali, whereas he, even though he's a politician, he's an outspoken politician. He knows what he wants, and he's also open about it. He's also a person who is definitely more funny, and I think actually more mature than Ala Shaheen. But, again, we are all talking about Egyptian men here, so don't
Okay.
expect too much.
But let me ask you, based on your extensive knowledge of the situation and your personal experiences with the characters involved here, who is the best selection for the future of Egyptology? And where do you see this going? Is there a hope? Is there a prayer? Is there a chance that with the demise of Hawass and with with a new regime coming in to the Egyptian government and to the world of Egyptian antiquities, can we, dare to hope that people like Andy Collins may actually be able to explore their discoveries? Can we dare to hope that this lid, this ironclad lid that has been on top of the Giza Plateau for such a long time, that has not allowed any additional information, additional discoveries to be known or released? Do we dare believe that all of that is going to change? And if we do, who is the best person to have on that plateau, to have in that chair of the Antiquities Department to open things up to greater discovery?
Well, I think, what we had with Hawass was a very strange picture. Hawass is a guy whose education was paid for by the Casey Foundation, who, even this year he's dashing off to Virginia Beach to be at a keynote speaker at their conference. But at the same time, he didn't allow them to do any testing there. He is very vociferous about how that there is no such thing or potential about new discoveries to be made. But there's also an extreme amount of ignorance. Ibrahim Ali, 30 Egyptologists, which I met in Sarajevo, for example, none of them knew that there were pyramids in Peru, and that proper archaeologists with better credentials than most of the Egyptologists there, and this includes Ibrahim Ali and Ala Shaheen, had dated these Peruvian pyramids to 3200 BC, and that the ancient Egyptian pyramids were A, no longer the oldest, and B, no longer the biggest. And this came as a shock to them. And this, I think, is actually something which I hope they will build onto, which is the fact that Hawass sat on so much scientific evidence, including carbon dating, which shows that the Egyptian pyramids are about 500 to 700 years older than reported right now, that the new wave of archaeologists, a new regime in ancient Egypt, actually says, oh, hold on, we have lost this prime position of being the cradle of civilization and the greatest pyramid builders ever. Let's just release somehow these carbon 14 results, which actually will show that ancient Egypt is older right now and will once again take more prominence amongst the cultures of the world. And so I think the future might look good for those kind of things, things which show that ancient Egypt is older, is better, is more beautiful than anything else. But if you are trying to engineer it or propose to Egyptian government that we should look for the Hall of Records because that will show evidence of Atlantis, that won't work for the simple reason that they will say, well, you know, if this is true, then where does that leave the ancient Egyptian civilization? It will once again be something which wasn't native to Egypt, and it'll be somewhere else. And that is something which I think isn't going to happen in the next few years. But a lot of it will depend, I think, on the general climate which is in Egypt, which right now keeps having that power. And I think this kind of like rolls on to what else is happening, because what started in Tunisia, what happened in Egypt, and to some extent what has concluded in Egypt, revolution-wise, is going up everywhere in the Middle East. It's Bahrain, it's Iran, it's Libya in so much power. Just kind of like little notes, kind of like, you know, there's clearly something going on once again in Israel and the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, because just a few days ago Israel was bombing the Palestinians once again. That entire Middle Eastern area is in flames and is trying to oust the powers that are. And you can see how we in the West really do not know how to cope with this. It's clear that we're helping the rebels in Benghazi into fighting their bombs being thrown by Gaddafi. But when it comes to Bahrain, it's clear that it's a hands-off policy. It's, to some extent, you know, I think there are several factors here. One of them is the West can't intervene in all of these places because it literally is a region set afoot. But at the same time, going into certain places is upsetting the current paradigm so much that the Western powers don't want that.
Well, yeah, but I mean, let's be really honest here. Everywhere that we are involved in the Middle East is somewhere that is beneficial to us in terms of oil. And we will not ever go into Bahrain, and we will not ever help the people of Bahrain, because the people who are attacking them are being aided by the Saudis. The Americans are never, ever, ever going to do anything that upsets Saudi Arabia. It is simply not going to happen. Sad but true. And as much as I have tremendous sympathy and care about what's happening to the rebels in Libya, when the first thing I read when I wake up in the morning is that gas is going to go up a dollar a gallon because of our involvement in Libya, you know, the conspiracy theorist in the back of my brain says, you know, is there something else going on here? And I don't think that you have to be a genius or a conspiracy theorist to figure this out. I mean, you know, we only get involved in places where it is going to be beneficial for us, period. You know, and it is tricky. I mean, Jon Stewart was actually hilarious and brilliant, as he and his staff always are on The Daily Show last night. You know, I always joke that every time Jon Stewart goes on vacation, he actually causes the world to go into chaos, because every week The Daily Show is on hiatus, huge things happen in the world and they have to get all caught up. Every time he goes on vacation, we say, oh gosh, you know, what's going to happen in the world now? And he opened his show last night after a week of vacation saying, when we left, the most important subjects we were talking about were Wisconsin and the set of Two and a Half Men. We came back to this horrific tragedy in Japan, the terrifying dangers of nuclear energy being exposed to everybody, and we're now in a third war. And this all happened over the course of about 2 weeks. But one of the things that he said that I thought was, so brilliant and so funny was, wars are not like children. You can't, leave the youngest one alone and expect that the older two are going to take care of it. How many fronts are we going to be on? And I don't know what the answer is. I think it's a very difficult situation because, the liberal defender in me wants to go out and be the defender of the world. There is a piece of me that thinks, yeah, we have to be the 911 call to people who really, really need it. But the pragmatist in me says, how long can we do this? And the conspiracy theorist in me says, what is the criteria that America is using to determine who to help and when to help them?
Yes, and I think, I mean, actually, I'm quite pleased as to how the Libyan case came about, because what's happening, just as a background and kind of like where we're heading to, is that Gaddafi was losing power in Libya. Half of his country had been overrun by the rebels, the freedom fighters, the people who want to get rid of him. And what Gaddafi had been doing was importing children from Africa. And these are your typical 11, 12, 13 years old with guns who are quite often bigger than their height. And they are fighting for Gaddafi. They are dying for Gaddafi. And he was launching rocket attacks at his own people. And this is what the UN tried to do. They wanted to have a no-flying zone over Libya so that he was unable to do this. And then, of course, he continued to do this. But I think what is the beauty and the hope of Libya is that for once the United Nations worked, and it worked quickly. We can debate about the motives of it, but the United Nations was this beautiful idea after the terrible things and of World War II that we should start working together as nations, that we weren't ready yet to let go of all the borders, but that at least we seem to have some common goals and that we should work together in a united way, in United Nations. And ever since 1940s, when it was established, it never was. It was a center of division. It showed what was wrong with the world. In the Cuban Missile Crisis, it didn't help at all. It was phone conversations between Khrushchev and Kennedy, almost pleading to each other not to do this, and a very mature handling of those two men, that we didn't go to war, that we didn't annihilate this planet, because that is how close that the Cuban Missile Crisis came. So the UN never did anything, and the best example is probably in 2001 after 9/11, where you had Colin Powell and Tony Blair trying to do something about the situation of that time, and by trying to involve the UN, and then Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld, and whereas Bush at first was willing to go with Powell and Bush, sorry, with Powell and Blair, it became quickly clear that A, they didn't have the power in the White House to actually push this through, and then Iraq happened, and so the UN has never been, in its practically 6 decades of existence, anything of a power. But all of a sudden, we are able to see it work. And I think that's actually a minor miracle. It kind of, just on its own, that it was quick, it was decisive, and it was acted upon. And at this, at a moment in time of great international preoccupations, because what has been dominating the news and what has been probably one of the biggest tragedies of the last decades is what has happened in Japan.
Yeah, and before we get into the specifics of certain elements of what Japan has woken us up to, I think it's extremely important to say first and foremost that our hearts, our prayers, our heartbreak is very, very real for the people of Japan. It has been such a terrible thing to watch this beautiful nation of people deal with so much tragedy and so much destruction. And I just, you know, pray that, there are hundreds of thousands of people in Japan right now who are homeless. And I can't even imagine what it's like there right now and how difficult it's going to be to manage all of that. So first and foremost, I think it's important to look at the human tragedy that has and is happening there over the last couple of weeks. And continue to pray, continue to support the Red Cross and the efforts of other organizations that are sending aid to them, and not to forget it. Sometimes over here we get so busy with everything else that's happening here, and currently there is so much to distract us. Is our house being foreclosed upon? Are we at war? There are so many things happening in the world right now that I think it's important that we don't allow ourselves to forget about Japan and forget about the fact that, you know, these are our brothers and sisters across the Pacific and that we need to be there for them. There's a lot of humanitarian efforts going on right now to help Japan. And every little bit helps, whether you're texting $10 to American Idol or giving a donation to the Red Cross, whatever it is. I think that we all need to be very cognizant of helping Japan. With that said, this has brought up a lot of issues for me personally, and specifically the idea of the safety or lack thereof of nuclear power. I think that one of the things that comes of this that is good is that it becomes a wake-up call. It's good if we allow it to be. If we allow this to be a wake-up call to the fact that nuclear energy is not safe. This idea of, quote, clean and safe energy that comes from nuclear power is a myth. And people have been trying to tell us this for 30 plus years. I marched against the building of the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant in the late 70s. You know, this is 30 plus years ago that we were screaming that this is not safe. Now, one of the things I want to say is that where we live in California, this particular nuclear power plant, Diablo Canyon, is built in between not one, but two earthquake faults. It has become known recently as a result of what's happening in Japan, as a result of what's happening with the nuclear disaster there. And make no mistake, it is a disaster. That we need to be paying close attention to what's happening at home. So one of the things that comes of this is we now discover that Diablo Canyon, sitting in between two earthquake faults, including one that has produced an 8.0 earthquake, which I lived through and was made homeless by, has no earthquake strategy. It has no emergency earthquake strategy. It wasn't required to have one, which is outrageous to me. And it's also been revealed, and to my knowledge, no one in the nuclear industry disputes this, that it cannot sustain anything over about a 6.5 earthquake. Well, we now know that we are looking at fault lines that can produce earthquakes that are much, much bigger than this. We need to be paying attention. This could happen off the coast of California, and it could happen tomorrow. It can happen all over the world. We have got to wake up and realize the nuclear reactors in this country are all over 30 years old. They're worn out. They're outdated. They do not have proper emergency systems. They don't have proper backup strategies, and they certainly are not made for earthquakes. When I started talking about this on Facebook recently, I got, you know, kind of typically expected responses from those who are going to defend nuclear energy. Oh, well, this was a freak accident. No, it wasn't a freak accident. Earthquakes happen from earthquake faults. If you build a nuclear reactor on an earthquake fault and you have an earthquake, you have to be prepared for that to happen. And what you have to be prepared for is the enormity and the magnitude of what can happen in a nuclear accident. But the thing that annoys me the most when we talk about nuclear energy is that those defenders of it say stupid things like, oh, well, nobody died from the nuclear accident in Fukushima. They only died from the earthquake. Someone actually said to me, well, people died from the tsunami, so maybe that should mean we shouldn't just build houses by the ocean. Okay, that's ridiculous. We all know that that's ridiculous. The thing with Fukushima, the thing with all nuclear accidents, is there is no way of knowing how many people have died or are going to die, more specifically, because of these accidents. The type of illness, the type of fatalities that occur as a result of nuclear radiation are things that can take us 10, 20, 30 years in the future to truly understand. And I don't want to take that kind of chance with my children, with the people in my community, with the people on this planet. We are playing Russian roulette with people's lives as long as we let the current setup of nuclear power in this country continue.
Yes, and when I look at Japan was obviously the only place where atomic power was ever used in an act of war. And it was also a country which, together with Germany, was attacked and bombed back to the Stone Age. And so it's from the late 1940s onwards that we see this massive regeneration, because both Germany and Japan all of a sudden realized that they could start from scratch and build according to whatever was in vogue in the 1940s in the middle of the 20th century. In both cases, they became extremely powerful economies. Our cars are either German or they are Japanese, even in America. One of the most patriotic countries on this planet, you will find this is the case. Our televisions are pretty much all Japanese. Our telephones, except if you're still with Nokia, but even they have made a deal with a Japanese company, are Japanese. Our computers are Japanese. Most of what technology we have in our daily life is pointing from Japan. And that is one observation which shows you how much this country is and is creating our modern environment. At the same time, It's also, I think, you know, this nuclear energy is also something which is a child of the 20th century. There was a lot of science involved, and obviously science is more and more dominating this worldview. But it was also a lot of bad science. Fukushima was said to be able to withstand a 7.2. Okay, that's great if you're building a power plant in Scotland, where the last earthquake was about 360 million years ago when there were volcanoes. But we all know that Japan is on the Ring of Fire. Which bit of you are building a nuclear reactor on a fault line don't you get? Responsibility is this. When I was speaking to the person who was building the largest and which is still the largest building in the world in Dubai, when I said, okay, you have built this gigantically beautiful and gigantically tall structure, what is it able to withstand? And he basically said, it's able to withstand any earthquake, no problem. And then he said something which I will always remember. He said, it's able to withstand a wind which blows once every 10,000 years. He said, no matter what you throw at this structure, if it falls, then it's because of a structural fault, which we didn't execute correctly or anything like that. But the design and everything, we have done everything in our power to make sure that this thing stands forever, for thousands of years, unless we break it down or because of some structural problem with it, which we hadn't foreseen. But we tested it for everything. And I think that is the difference between what I would call a 20th century scientific mindset and somebody who actually realizes that you need to test certain things for everything. Because taking shortcuts simply will spell out disaster. And that is what's happening in Japan. And what I like, if there is such a term, within the context, is that when the disaster of Japan, which again we will probably not know the extent of for weeks and if there's withholding of evidence for decades, is the fact that countries are beginning to reconsider their nuclear energy, and specifically Germany, who began this adventure with Japan. Angela Merkel basically said she is trying to steer her country away from nuclear energy now. Other countries like Venezuela and various others are also reconsidering it. And there was one program which we recently saw in which it actually said that 5% or something of Arizona's landmass, if that were handed over to natural powers of making energy, would actually be able to power everybody in America. And I think that is a very good use of pretty much non-used space in Arizona to bring about a true energy revolution. And I know that in the past and today there are still industries like the nuclear energy industry and the electricity energy and all of those people who hang on to the past and the ways of doing it, but endorsing new ways of thinking and actually investing in them, because there's an awful lot of investment required into these new technologies. If the old powers that were to invest in the new powers, they would realize that they're actually going to probably make more money in the short to long-term future. It's just a willingness to change which is lacking from all of the old columns, the old powers, the old pillars of power. And I think that's the problem, the willingness to change. And if you're unwilling to change, then something will happen that will force you to change. And unfortunately, it's 15,000, if not more, people dead, and an almost disastrous meltdown, if not a true meltdown, in Japan, which has forced people to basically start looking at alternatives.
Yeah, I mean, we have to look at these things as a wake-up call if they are not to be solely tragedies. We have the ability to take these tragedies and learn from them and do something about them with this information that we are learning, this wisdom that we are gaining from living through these tragedies. That's what we're being called to do. We're being called to wake up. If we don't listen, then we don't have the right to moan when it happens again. So that's what I feel. I feel that we are really being called to wake up and make some changes. Like you, I was completely floored by that statistic we heard the other day, that if we used 5% of the Arizona desert, the solar power that could be generated from that would be enough to fulfill the energy needs of the majority of the United States of America. I mean, even if that's only, possibly true, why aren't we looking at that? And I certainly, that is one of my prayers for the future, is that we really will wake up, we really will learn from what's happening around us, and we will begin to investigate far more sustainable, safe, cleaner ways of finding energy.
Yes, because I think there's this belief, and specifically in the New Age, I always feel that what we're doing, our way of living, is somehow, at odds. We should do certain things, but it's the fact that it's almost this dream, which always upsets me, that somehow there has to be a judgment. There are too many people on this planet, and some of them have to go. That's kind of like this underlying message which you get from not just the New Age movement, but obviously from fundamentalist people as well. And it's simply not true. But it's the method through which we are sustaining ourselves that is wrong. But it doesn't really matter whether it's 6 billion or 100 million. The methods which we're employing right now are the problem. And we have the technology, we have the capability and capacity to actually align this with more sustainable and better energy and anything else. You're always saying Mitsubishi is the greatest destroyer of the Amazonian rainforest. And that is kind of the evidence which is out there and which so few people know and realize. it doesn't have to be like that. We can all live extremely comfortably, probably even better off than we are today, if we just had a willingness to change certain things. The planet would be better, we would be better, we would be healthier, we would be living in a better environment. All it takes is a bit of courage.
I want to close out this show today, because it is my birthday and I get to do whatever I want, with a very beautiful prayer that was given to me in the labyrinth. This last weekend we were in New Mexico with some beautiful friends, including Max the Crystal Skull, who we will talk about a little bit more maybe next week or in the next 2 weeks. We might even be able to get his keeper, Joanne Parks, on with us, and we'll talk about what the ancient artifacts have to say to us right now, and how wonderful it is to have these artifacts around and what they remind us of in terms of ancient wisdom. But it was a wonderful weekend for us because we were able to really explore and celebrate this type of ancient wisdom. And one of the ways in which I love to do that is in walking labyrinths. And there happens to be a particularly beautiful outdoor labyrinth in Albuquerque. And one of the things that I got on this labyrinth walk, the message to me, was that we all limit ourselves far too much in terms of what we believe and what we feel. We forget that divine intelligence is so much bigger, so much broader than we can possibly imagine. We sometimes try to solve our problems, whether it's our personal problems or our larger community society problems, with the limited information that we have. And sometimes the lesson for us is to just be a lot more open to possibilities, to stop restricting ourselves. Specifically, I was told, allow yourself to be surprised by what God can do in your life. And I always want to say, my disclaimer here is, however you look at God, God, goddess, divine mind, spirit, call it whatever you want, but allow yourself to be open to the powers of what divine can work with us. And I want to leave you with this little prayer that I am now saying every morning when I get up. And I wanted to share it with you because it's already working wonders in my life. Today, I will allow myself to be surprised by God. I will invite and welcome the miracles which are so effortless to the divine mind. I will be open to the greatness and generosity, to the unparalleled imagination. I will respond with gratitude and dwell in the light of wonder. So with that, I hope you all have an amazing week until we meet you again, dwelling in the light of wonder, allowing yourself to be surprised by God. And until next week, the truth against the world.